This afternoon, we're looking at 1 Samuel 30, if you care to turn there in your Bibles. 1 Samuel chapter 30, how shall we then live? Now, this is a difficult time. I don't have too much problem because I have to speak, but I never liked to have a class in seminary that I had to teach right after lunch. And in a few minutes, I'll know why, and you probably will too. but we won't call names if you doze off. It's just something about lunch. You got to have it, but it kind of slows you down, I think. And I want to say thank you not only to those who are attending, but a number of you are pastors who have to preach tomorrow, and you came here, of all things. I have to say, I would be so paranoid about having to preach tomorrow that I probably wouldn't have come. but that's a marvelous thing that so many of you are here, and we respect and thank you for that. Now let's look at 1 Samuel 30, and let's read through it. It's a bit long, but let's get it in front of us. Now when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, the Amalekites had made a raid against the Negev and against Ziklag. They had overcome Ziklag and burned it with fire and taken captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great. They killed no one, but carried them off and went their way. Now when David and his men came to the city, they found it burned with fire and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. And then David and the people who were with him raised their voices and wept until they had no more strength to weep. David's two wives also had been taken captive, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David was greatly distressed, for the people spoke of stoning him because all the people were bitter in soul, each for his own, for his sons and daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God, and David said to Abiathar the priest, the son of Ahimelech, "Bring me the ephod." So Abiathar brought the ephod to David, and David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I pursue after this band? Shall I overtake them?" He answered him, "Pursue, for you will surely overtake and shall surely rescue." So David set out, the 600 men who were with him, and they came to the brook Besor, where those who were left behind stayed. But David pursued, he and 400 men. 200 stayed behind, who were too exhausted to cross the brook Besor. They found an Egyptian in the open country and brought him to David. And they gave him bread and he ate. They gave him water to drink, and they gave him a piece of a cake of figs and two clusters of raisins. And when he had eaten, his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and 3 nights. And David said to him, "To whom do you belong, and where are you from?" He said, "I am a young man of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite, and my master left me behind because I fell sick 3 days ago. We had made a raid against the Negev of the Kerethites and against that which belongs to Judah and against the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag with fire." David said to him, "Will you take me down to this band?" And he said, "Swear to me by God that you will not kill me or deliver me into the hands of my master, and I will take you down to this band." And when he had taken him down, behold, they were spread abroad all over the land, eating and drinking and dancing because of the great spoil they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. And David struck them down from twilight until the evening of the next day, and not a man of them escaped, except 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken, and David rescued his two wives. Nothing was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that had been taken. David brought back all. David also captured all the flocks and herds, and the people drove the livestock before him and said, "This is David's spoil." Then David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow David and who had been left at the brook Besor, and they went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. And when David came near to the people, he greeted them. Then all the wicked and worthless fellows among the men who had gone with David said, "Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we've recovered, except that each man may lead away his wife and children and depart." But David said, "You shall not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us. He has preserved us and given into our hand the band that came against us. He would listen to you in this matter, for as his share is who goes down into the battle, so shall his share be who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike." And he made it a statute and a rule for Israel from that day forward to this day. When David came to Ziklag, he sent part of the spoil to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, "Here's a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord." It was for those in Bethel, in Ramoth of the Negev, in Jatir, in Aroer, in Sifmoth, in Eshtmoah, in Rakal, in the cities of the Jerameelites, in the cities of the Kenites, in Hormah, in Borashan, and in Athak, in Hebron, for all the places where David and his men had roamed. Now there's, of course, that book title by Francis Schaeffer, which is roughly, I don't know if I have it exactly, but "How Shall We Then Live?" But we're not concerned here in using that question with how you live in a post-Christian culture, but just how you live in your multiple troubles. Once again, we know David has a special place in the history of redemption, etc., as the covenant king, and yet there's much spillover for any child of God as you look at David's experiences that were recorded for us and for our instruction. So wave upon wave, remember we've come, or we would have come if we'd had time to read it, from 1 Samuel 18 on, clear to almost the end of 1 Samuel, and wave upon wave of trouble has come upon David. And now it's even a more grievous kind of trouble, because in chapter 29 you had that superb welcome relief that came to David when he didn't have to go fight against his own people, and marvelously seems, and yet naturally, in one sense, he was delivered. And with what a light heart they must have started back from Aphek to go back to Ziklag, the place where they were staying and where their family and loved ones were, and so on. Well, you know it before David does, because in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 30, the writer tells you, the reader, and you know all about it. David just hears about it or sees it when he sees the ruin of Ziklag in verse 3. That's the first he knows. But the writer has cushioned you, so you know what's coming about Ziklag being burned and all the people being taken captive and so on. And then, verse 3, David and his men come, and they're devastated because of what happened. You can understand that, can't you? It's almost as if, not really, I guess, but almost as if, you almost say, "I almost wish I hadn't experienced the relief of chapter 29, because it's as if the Lord lifts me up, and now in chapter 30, I come down with a thud again. And here's more trouble, and who knows if we'll ever recover those people," and so on. That they probably didn't even know who exactly had taken them captive. So there we are, and you have the question that comes to you, and someone has said is pressed upon you as you read through these chapters of David's experience, and you say, "Will this man's suffering never cease?" It just seems like there's one more thing, always one more weight, always one more burden, always one more disaster coming upon him. And there are many of the Lord's people who are living through times like that. How shall we then live? As David says in Psalm 40, "For troubles without number surround me." When that happens, how do you go on? How do you live in circumstances like that? I think our passage for Samuel 30, verses 10 to 31, suggests several ways that we go on living. First of all, by providence. By providence. You see that in verses 11 to 20 here. You notice it says in verse 11, "They found an Egyptian in the open country and brought him to David," and so on. Now they are on their way. After they recover a little bit as far as the first emotional impact and so on, and they grieve like Middle Eastern people do, and so on. And then because he inquires through Abiathar the priest, David has the assurance, verse 8, from Yahweh that he will indeed catch these folks and he'll recover everything. And so they go on their way and all of that. And they go to the brook Besor, which is about, which is sort of the border of southern Canaan as you go to Egypt. And 200 men just can't go on. Well, you have to understand, now you think they came from Aphek in chapter 29, and they came down to Ziklag. That would be about 60 miles. Who knows how long that took them? Did it take them 3 days, whatever, 3-4 days? And then they meet what they meet in Ziklag. The town is desolated, the population taken captive, etc. And there's the emotional distress of mourning, at least initially, over that. And then they go 15 more miles from Ziklag to the brook Besor, and so on. Some of these fellows are just plain wiped out. They can't go any further. And so David takes 400 with him, leaves 200 behind. Now, verse 11, the first part of the verse, they found an Egyptian and so on, just doesn't seem to be consequential at all. It seems rather trivial and so on, but it's really the connecting link between verses 8 and 18. Verse 8 was Yahweh's assurance. Pursue, for you shall surely overtake and shall surely rescue. And verse 18 and following, David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken, and David rescued his two wives, etc. So David got back all. What Yahweh had said and what Yahweh had assured and what he had promised actually came about. But what's the connecting link? It's this Egyptian, verse 11. Otherwise, David discovers from this fella who did it, who attacked Ziklag, and where he might, and he knows someone who could take him to find them, to catch up with them. You may think, well, okay, that's a wonderful thing, but otherwise David probably wouldn't have known. He may not even have known that they were the Amalekites that did it. People didn't leave calling cards. They didn't make phone calls and take responsibility, etc. They didn't take cans of spray paint and write Amalek rules on the walls of the city hall in Ziklag, for example. You didn't necessarily know who did it. How are you going to know how to catch them? How are you going to know where to go? How would you know, even if you did know they were Amalekites, how would you know where they might have gone? They're so elusive. But here's an Egyptian. And he was a servant, a slave to an Amalekite. And that Amalekite dropped him because he was so sick 3 days ago, left him behind like trash, and left him probably to die. And David's men find him, and they ply him with bread and water, some raisins and figs and so on, and he tells them where the Amalekites are, and if they pledge not to give him back to his original master, he'll take them down there. Do you see how everything just hangs on this one thing and this one item, and how this Amalekite master later, looking back on it, if he lived, must have reprimanded himself for thinking that this Egyptian was just a bunch of trash to be left behind because he became the treasure for David. Sometimes it's like that. Things are the opposites and so on. Don McClure, Presbyterian missionary to the Sudan and Ethiopia, this probably happened back in the 1950s. He told of a worship service that they had among the Shula people in Sudan. And he told that it was quite remarkable. I think they had 200, 250 people coming into this dirt-packed little chapel that they had made and so on. But Don McClure said there were certain things that kept him from concentrating as he was preaching to the people in that service. And one of them was this Shula man. Well, I need to back up. One of the missionary wives had thrown away an old corset into the trash. I guess it's a girdle, wasn't doing the job, and she threw it away. It was no good. But then into the worship service came this Shula man who had apparently rummaged through the trash And he had this corset, and he came in with great dignity, wearing it on his head. And McClure said the interesting thing about it was, you know, he did that, but he didn't have anything else at all on. But he seemed to think, to one woman, it was just an old useless girdle, but to this man, it was a crown. And for David, this Egyptian was a prize. He may have been trash to his master, but this is just what David needed. Have you ever thought about how the we put some things in quotes, don't we? Inconsequential providences of God, and how your life just depends on them sometimes. Like an Egyptian here. Or like that story that Spurgeon told in his lectures to my students. He talked about a minister who was fleeing from some of the king's men. I suppose this was back in the 1600s. And he said that the minister ran into a malt house and ran inside and squeezed himself through the entryway to the entrance to the kiln and dropped down in there. And as soon as he did, he looked back up through that entrance he had come in, and he noticed immediately that there was a spider that began weaving her web, going across the line across that entrance, and just kept it up. And according to Spurgeon, he almost forgot his danger, if you can believe that, as he looked at the light shining at the angle there and noticed that spider, became entranced with the spider doing her work and weaving the web and so on. And not too long, apparently, there was this beautiful spider's web across there, and then he heard them come in, and the men came in, and they started clanging around and cursing there in a malt house and searching through it and so on. And then there was one of them that came over near the entrance to the kiln, and the other one stopped him short and said, "It's no use looking in there. The old villain couldn't be in there. Look at that spider's web. He couldn't have gotten in there without breaking it." And they left. Or, you know, not all of the Lord's providences are in 1 Samuel 30 or in the 1600s, are they? I remember one of my brothers telling me of being called. They were away from home, and they were at an American football game, and he was paged from the press box to come up to the press box, I guess. Well, that's not usually a good sign. But he gets up there, and they tell Glenn, your daughters are okay. they wanted to send word to this fact so that if my brother happened to hear this on the news, he wouldn't be worried. What had happened? Well, their two younger daughters had three daughters, and I think the oldest was away at school probably, and the two younger daughters, who I think were teenagers at the time, were staying at their house in the Kansas City area. But as a kind of a precaution, at nighttime, they were to go across to the neighbors across the street and stay overnight at the neighbor's place. So that's what they were doing. It came time, and so the two girls, Beth and Carolyn, made ready to leave and go over to the neighbors. And just as they were ready to go out the door and lock it, the phone rang. Go back in, answer the phone, take care of whatever it was. In the meantime, there was a small aircraft that came flying over and crashed into the neighbor's house. The neighbors themselves apparently were around the dining room table or some table where they were eating that was further to the front of the house. They weren't injured, but the plane crashed into their family room in the back, which would have been the room where my brother's two daughters would have been had they been on time. Thirsty Egyptians and speedy spiders and nagging phone calls, and you can add your own items from your own list, or it could be something else. How do we live in the maze of our troubles? We live by providence. By God's providence opening the door. Sorry, I have to be general. I don't know your situations. By God's providence opening a door. Or holding off a tragedy, and we may not see it at the time. Or a merciful twist that he gives to our circumstances, or some tiny detail by which he leaves his fingerprints over and on our affairs, so that we know in all our troubles we at least have not been deserted. We live by providence. Secondly, we live by grace. By grace. Verses 21 to 25. Now, David was able to recover everything. Verses 18 to 20. They went down, they found those Amalekites distracted and partying and so on, and they laid into them. And David, they recovered all the people they had taken captive. Now, you might say, well, those Amalekites were more merciful than David. David actually obliterated everybody in chapter 27 on his raids. Well, that may be true, but the Amalekites didn't take them captive and keep them alive because they had the milk of human kindness in them. They would take them captive in order either to enslave them themselves or sell them into slavery to others. You know, that's the way to make a living. But David recovered everything. Now, you notice what happens when they come back. These nasty fellows, verse 22, among these 400 men that went with David, said about the 200 that stayed behind that were too exhausted to press on, because they did not go with us, verse 22, we will not give them any of the spoil that we've recovered. Every man can take his own wife and children, go away, but we're not going to give them anything that we've brought back because we're the ones that put in the work. They can take their people and leave, and so on. And then you notice how David, in verse 23, responds to that. He said, "You shall not do so, my brothers, with what Yahweh has given us. He has preserved us and given into our hand the band that came against us." David is saying that we live by grace, and we need to recognize he not only lays down the law the way it's going to be, but he gives an argument for why it must be that way. And the argument is, Yahweh has given this to us. This is a gift. And you must get that into your thick skulls. I don't doubt that David said that to those men. You remember 1 Samuel 22, this motley bunch of people that were following David were a bunch of malcontents and in debt and all sorts of bunch of kind of thugs, I suppose. They were kind of a disaster, and it's a tribute to David's leadership that he could keep a congealed group like that formed together. But he stepped on them on this case, and he said, "You shall not do so, my brothers, with what Yahweh has given to us." In other words, all we've received is from the goodness of God, and you're acting as if you deserved it, and you're not recognizing the source of it. Sometimes we need that reminder. There's that Peanuts cartoon strip where Snoopy, the dog, is looking at his water bowl, and it's empty, and he thinks to himself, "It's empty and I'm dying of thirst." So he takes it in his snout. I don't know how dogs do this, but in cartoons you can do anything. And so he takes it in his snout, and he takes his doggy bowl to a spigot or a faucet. It's just a pipe coming out of the ground with a tap or a spigot on it, and he holds it under there. For several frames of the cartoon, nothing happens. Let's hold it under there, nothing happens. And then it begins to rain. And it rains very, very hard. And obviously is filling up Snoopy's bowl as he stands under the tap that isn't working. And so he takes the bowl back to his doghouse, and he drinks the water that collected in his bowl. Gets up on his doghouse, and he said, "I'm going to have to think about that one for a while." Now, he was dealing with grace, in a way. It may not come through secondary matters like a water tap and so on, but as James 1:17 would say, every generous act and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights. We live by grace. You see, for many of us, and I fear for myself too much, grace is a concept. It's a We know how to define it, etc., etc., but it's too much of merely a concept. For David, grace is a way of thinking. For David, it's a worldview that controls the way he looks at things. This is what Yahweh has given to us. It's grace isn't just restricted to the way I enter the kingdom of God, but it reigns over all of life. All I have is Yahweh's gift, and I cannot respond then in greed or in anger, but only with gratitude. This came home to me once when I was teaching in college, and we had a chapel speaker at that college, and his orthodoxy theologically wasn't probably exactly online. He was suspect, I suppose, in some areas, but there was one thing that I think he hit right on target. He was talking about his daughter. I don't know how old she was. I think she was in single digits and so on, maybe 7, 8, I don't know. And I don't know what her particular malady was, whether it might have been epilepsy or it might have been leukemia, something like that, but she died. He was speaking in reference to Job 1:21. The Lord has given and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That text makes me tremble when I think about whether I could do that. But his point was that he had to come to the place where he realized that everything he had, even his daughter, obviously, was a gift of grace. And he had no claim on anything he had. Everything he had was a divine gift. So if God took a gift away, he said, did I have any room to complain? It was his gift. He granted it to me. And if he wants to take his gift away, he has a right to do what he wants with what is his. That's hard stuff. Some of you have been there. You may be there now. But that was his point. Life is ruled by God's grace. I have no claim. I can receive with gratitude. I can't demand. And so on. I think he was right. It reminds me of that story that Ian Murray, well, it's not a story, it's just a little clip. Ian Murray tells in his biography of John Murray, who taught at Westminster Seminary back in the 50s, 60s, and for a number of years. And in a footnote in that biography of John Murray, he refers to another John Murray who lived in Sutherland in the 19th century. And he said this John Murray, on one occasion, had a friend drop in and he stayed for the noontime meal. The noontime meal, that was the same as all noontime meals at the time, potatoes and salt. And the visitor was trying to empathize with John Murray when he said it was a pity about the potato, how poor the potatoes were. He wasn't griping about the meal. He was trying to sympathize with, isn't it too bad? This is all really we have here, and the potatoes are very poor. So he was trying to be sympathetic. And John Murray said to him, there's not a one of them on which I don't see the beauty of the blood. What on earth was he saying? I think he was saying that he was living by grace. I think he was saying that everything I have is a purchase that the Redeemer has made for me. And if I have lousy potatoes, at least they're the gift of my Savior to me. And we live by grace. Everything flows from him. So therefore, this meal I have, this walk I can enjoy with my wife, this shelter when it's raining, this job I have, this son, this daughter, this dear Christian friend these 4 hours of uninterrupted sleep. I have by grace. We live by grace. Thirdly, we live by wisdom. Verses 26 to 31, if you look there. Now you notice what happens here is that David sends the spoil. Remember, he's not only recovered his stuff, as we say, but he's also taken spoil from the Amalekites and so on. And he comes back to Ziklag and he sends this plunder to his friends, the elders of Judah. And then in verses 27 to 31, it gives you the addresses of these fellows, 13 place names without the postcodes, of course. But there they are, Bethel, Ramoth of Gilead, Jatir, etc., etc., Borashan, Athok, and Hebron, etc. All of those were places where David sent spoil from the Amalekites. Now, this would help pave the way for something you see in 2 Samuel chapter 5, or rather it's chapter 2, 2 Samuel chapter 2, verses 1 to 4. In that chapter, it speaks about how David went to Hebron under God's command. Hebron, about 19 miles south-southwest of Jerusalem, there about 3,300 feet elevation in the Judean hills and so on. And David went to Hebron, and he was anointed king by his own tribe, the tribe of Judah. How did that happen? Well, I'm not saying that this is the whole reason, but this certainly didn't hurt. You send gifts to the town councils and the elders of these various communities of the spoil and plunder you took, and you send those gifts to them. They're going to be a little bit more open to making you king. You say, oh, it smacks of bribery. That's not bribery. There was no law against it. I know the American Civil Liberties Union would be up in arms probably if it was in my country. But really, there was nothing wrong with this. It was wise. It would win him support. It was a proper thing to do. It was both proper and it was persuasive. And when the time came, they need a little nudge, perhaps. They say, oh, yeah, David's treated us well. Okay, I think he would make a fine king. Now, you may not like, you may think that's too crass, but I'm quite sure that this sort of thing was not unrecognized by the people of Judah when they came time to decide about whether David should be king. The point of this is, he's living by wisdom. It's okay to be both legal and, I don't know how you use the word, sharp. I guess by sharp, I mean rightly sharp, not a devious kind of. The Bible nowhere tells us that we have to check our brains when we enter the kingdom of God. It nowhere says that we can't use our creativity. One can be rightly sharp without being wrongly sinful. And that's what David was doing. This was godly savvy. Grease the wheels a little bit with a gift. There's no problem there. This is the kind of thing I think that Jesus was speaking about in Luke chapter 16 and verse 9 in the context, in the way we use our wealth. Now, my only point here is, in principle, this is the thing we need to do as Christian believers. We need to crave and to cultivate the use of wisdom in our Christian life and thinking and relationships. We don't necessarily do that. We're more taken in the church with power, or what we think is power, than we are with wisdom. Let me give you an example that I thought is sort of like David's here. This is one that John Whitecross passed along in his collection on the Shorter Catechism, but I don't know when this was, years ago, couple hundred years ago in the English Navy, I suppose, but there was a naval captain that was appointed to a ship, newly appointed to the ship, and it said that he said to his crew, "My lads, there is one law that I am determined to make, and I shall insist upon its being kept. Indeed, it's a favor which I ask of you, and which, as a British officer, I expect will be granted by a crew of British seamen. What say you, my lads? Are you willing to grant your new captain, who promises to treat you well, one favor? They cried, hi, hi. What is it? What is it? Why, my lads, he said, it is this, that you must allow me to swear the first oath in this ship. It's a law I cannot dispense with. I must insist upon it. I cannot be denied. No man on board must swear an oath before I do. I am determined to have the privilege of swearing the first oath on board Her Majesty's whatever. What say you, my lads? Will you grant me this favor? It seems so reasonable. The captain seems so pleasant, so affable, and so on, that they immediately cried out, hi, hi, sir. And the effect, of course, was that swearing was wholly abolished on the ship. Now, you might say, that was a little bit devious. No, it was wise. It was savvy. That's the sort of thing. Not that we can be that, we would say, maybe tricky or something. But no, it's really wisdom. But we don't have in the church or in our circles today much emphasis on wisdom. We're very impressed with the appearance of power and so on, but we don't care too much about wisdom. And I found in most pastoral situations where people have problems, it's not because that the problem is not because they don't have gifts or abilities. I very seldom, I can't even think of a situation where that's been the main problem. You know where I find that Christians have the main problem is that they don't have discernment. It's a matter of wisdom. And nobody cares about wisdom in the church because it doesn't seem to bring in members and all that sort of thing. But wisdom is simply, I think the book of Proverbs would hold this up, wisdom is simply skill and creativity in knowing how to live a godly life. Check it against Proverbs. Notice what Proverbs chapter 2 says. It says that wisdom is both a passion, or ought to be a passion, and it is a gift. The first part of Proverbs 2, wisdom is a passion. Call out for insight. Raise your voice for understanding. Seek it like silver. Search for it as for hidden treasure. It's a passion. And at the same time, and in the same breath, it's a gift. Because Proverbs 2:6 says, for Yahweh gives wisdom. It's a gift, and you must bend your whole being to seek to have it and to possess it. It's a skill, and skills take time. But we must learn to live by wisdom. You know, that's what the Apostle James told us, isn't it? You remember in James chapter 1, verse 5, that verse where it says, if any of you lack wisdom, let him ask the giving God, literally, and so on. And I think we sometimes think, well, James has gone on to another index card where he had his sermon notes, and it's divorced from everything that went before. But no, no, no. He had talked about how count it all joy, brothers, when you fall into multicolored trials, etc. And then you have verse 5. If any of you lack wisdom, wisdom for what? Well, wisdom to know how on earth you're going to negotiate your way through these multicolored troubles and distresses. You get hit with those things and you say, how am I going to walk through this? How am I going to step through this crud? How am I going to make it? You don't know how, so you ask for wisdom. You ask the giving God who gives to all generously without criticizing, and it will be given him. You need that. You need to walk by wisdom. But then fourthly, you notice I never say finally because you may get your hopes up. You just always keep to the numerals. So this is fourthly. It is finally, but I'm not going to tell you that. Fourthly, we live by hope. Verse 26. When David came to Ziklag, he sent part of the spoil to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, here's a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of Yahweh. The enemies of Yahweh. Look, a gift for you from the plunder of Yahweh's enemies. You notice what he said there? They're not just Israel's enemies, though they were that. You know, the Amalekites had a history And you may remember that in Exodus chapter 17, verses 8 to 16, they had attacked Israel when Israel was coming out of Egypt, and Joshua had encountered them in battle, and they had eventually won, and so on. And then you get to Deuteronomy 25 and verses 17 to 19, and Yahweh tells Moses and Israel that the day will come when he wants the Amalekites eliminated from the land because of what they did to Israel. And in Deuteronomy 25, he said, essentially, Amalek played dirty pool. When Israel came out of Egypt, they waited until people, some of them were straggling behind. They couldn't keep up. And then the Amalekites would gang up and wipe out those stragglers. It was dirty pool, etc. And so he said, the day will come when I want the Amalekites eliminated for this. And you may say, well, it gives me all sorts of problems. Well, let's deal with it later. But here's the thing. The Amalekites aren't just Israel's enemies. They are Yahweh's enemies. They dared to attack God's people, and thereby they became God's enemies. And David picks this up. This is not just a point of politics. There's a gift for you from the plunder of Yahweh's enemies. This is a matter of theology for David. Now, notice the recognition there is, and this is what I'm concerned about. Notice the assumption David makes in these words. There's a recognition here that we often forget. David assumes that there are two kingdoms. There are two seeds, S-E-E-D-S. There are two humanities in this world. And the time is coming when the one will be subjugated. In Psalm 110, verse 1, David said, Yahweh said to my Lord, the Messiah, Yahweh said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies the stool for your feet. That's what's going to happen to your enemies. Or Psalm 92:9, for lo, thy enemies, Yahweh, for lo, thy enemies shall perish. All evildoers shall be scattered. This is where it's headed. So for David, this victory over Amalek is not just another one to chalk up in the win column, but rather it's another victory in the coming of God's kingdom over all his enemies. Every triumph over the Amalekites, however little you may think about them, is a pledge of the final victory of Yahweh over his and all his people's enemies. That's the way they thought. That's the way Deborah thought in Judges chapter 5, verses 30 and 31. You remember after she, in her victory, her and Barak's victory song, after they defeated, Israel defeated the Canaanites under King Jabin and General Sisera and so on. And you remember how Deborah goes on at the end of Judges chapter 5 about how Jael had a crush on Sisera and so on. And the way she goes into that in graphic detail. And then how does she end that poem? So may all your enemies perish, O Yahweh. In other words, this victory you've given us over the Canaanites, you've put down Sisera, you've put down Jabin, you used Jael, etc., to do some of this and so on. So may all your enemies perish. This is just a small token of your final victory. That's the way it seems to me that David is thinking here. These are the enemies of Yahweh. And they've been defeated. They've been defeated this time. This is another foretaste of Yahweh's coming victory. This is the way we must look at the miracles of Jesus when you're reading them in the Gospels. Every time Jesus casts out demons or a demon from someone, you should see that as a pledge of Christ's complete victory over Satan and all of his works that is coming. Here's a defeat. This is a token of the final defeat that Jesus will inflict upon Satan and all his hosts. Every funeral that's canceled in Jesus' miracles. For instance, in Mark 5, when he said to Jairus' daughter, as he went back to that little cot, and he said, "Little girl, I say to you, rise," and he restored her to life. That's just a token of the power and the victory that Jesus has over death. It's a token of what he will do. It shows that even though one of his people has gone to the realm of death, they are not beyond the sound of Jesus' voice nor the reach of Jesus' power. And he will therefore destroy him who has the power of death, that is the devil. They're a pledge of a coming victory. I remember when I was a kid, I suppose 5, 6, 7 years old, my mother had it wasn't really a saucepan. It was more like a heavy pan kettle. It was pretty thick stuff, but it was the one that she always stirred up practically everything in. And if we were going to have, for instance, vanilla pudding or banana pudding, that was the one she would cook the pudding in. Now, being the youngest of the family, I would be hanging around the kitchen, of course, and when she was done, she would take the pudding and she would empty it into about half a dozen of these dessert dishes. You know, they don't hold enough to do anybody any good, particularly, but they look nice, and you might have a cup and a half of pudding in each one, and we would have those later for dessert, or if it was company, that was the dessert. But then she would give me the empty sauce kettle with the tablespoon she had used. And there was always not a lot, you know. This wasn't the plunder of the Amalekites or anything. Yeah, but there was a little bit in the bottom of the kettle and around the sides, and I might get maybe 3 teaspoons max out of that, but I got to lick it. Now, the important thing theologically for that is that what I ate and what I tasted was the very same stuff we'd be having later. It wasn't enough. It was only a foretaste. It was only a few bites, but it was the very same thing. And what you see in the victories through David of the Amalekites, or back in Deborah's day, the victory over the enemies of Yahweh, or in the miracles of Jesus, these are pledges, they are foretastes of the same kind of stuff that you have in completed form in the victory of Jesus' kingdom. We live by hope. And you need to have a clear view of last things. May be all that keeps you on your feet some days. I'm not kidding. Jesus will rule. This I know, for the Amalekites tell me so. And if that's not true, what reason do you have for getting up out of bed in the morning? We live by hope. So how shall we then live? Well, by providence, by grace, by wisdom, by hope. That's the short answer. It's as if in 1 Samuel 30, God brings out his whole arsenal of helps just to keep you standing. Let us pray. You bring us down again and again, our God. We begin to think that because we are on this side of the empty cross and the empty tomb, that somehow we are beyond David, but we have never caught up to David, O Lord. And yet we give you thanks that even though you humble us by the effect of this narrative upon us, nevertheless you show us that you are not above, as it were, coming down and getting yourself mixed up in the messy affairs of your people's lives. We so thank you for that. We thank you for this testimony. And we thank you in the name of the one who has been tempted in every respect as we are, yet without sin. Amen.